Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. You know the rest of that.
Okay, yeah.
Considering the circumstances.
Yes. It's been a while since I've seen you, but this is always good in that we are getting a lot of great artists to talk to. In particular, right now, we are with Peter Himmelman. He's got a new album called Press On. The Jerusalem Post has said that he is the world's second best Jewish singer-songwriter. So high praise indeed. I think the first best is Gene Simmons, probably. I'm not sure, but
That's what I'd heard from you.
Yeah. So that's great.
Matter of opinion.
Yeah. So welcome, Peter, to our show. Welcome to What Difference Does It Make?
Thanks. I like the title. I mean, maybe it's a real question you're asking.
We're wondering why another podcast, why do this, but it's an excuse to talk to people and artists that we love, welcome.
We ponder it a lot.
It seems to fit us and it seems to fit the world, so welcome. Let's get started with it.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's exciting because actually Peter's got his guitar. I think he said if the mood strikes him, he might start playing. So, you know, if there's a dead silence and that little awkwardness to the conversation, just throw in the guitar and start strumming away.
They call those interstitials in the business. Yes.
And we're back.
How's that? I do your own bumpers.
I love that.
Thank you. Dave and I have decided we have a lot of... We have a lot of random questions for you, but we want to talk about the new music first.
The more random, the better. Whatever you got, I'm here.
All right. So even though Press On is your new album, this was something that was made last year before this insanity happened. However, it seems to, like all great songwriters, it kind of can tie into what's going on in the world today. And I guess that starts with the title track, Press On. That seems to really tie into how we're feeling. And it's kind of like a motivation to keep going. Is that what was going on in your mind when you started that song?
Well, I mean, usually if I write a song that's successful, the less I have on my mind, the better. The less of I'm going to write a song about this or that, the better the song will be. Coming into this, just sitting down with a guitar with a feeling that a song is about to emerge without any sort of preconditions or expectations, only a very strong sense of there's something that needs to be born, is a very great way to go about things, I think. So it reminds me of Jasper Johns, the great American painter, when he said, why would I come to a canvas and paint what I already know? Which is not how the Renaissance painters felt, but he's sort of like Picasso had said similarly. I could paint like an adult as a child. And now as an adult, I strive to paint like a child. And a child doesn't know a lot, but they really have an intact sense of wonder. It's only that as we age, our minds go slack and we think we know things and our sense of curiosity and mystery is waylaid. So when I sat down to write this song, it was 5:45 one late afternoon or early evening. My wife had bid me to come in for dinner at 6, so I had 15 minutes to write it. You know, I knew this thing had to be born, so I just started writing. And you'll see there's not a lot of complex harmony on the song. Mm-hmm. But the words just kind of rolled out. And when they roll out like that, in a sense that, wow, what did I just say? What did I just write? I can go on stage and almost inhabit the song. It's like a small room I walk into. And when I sing the song, because I don't really know exactly what it means, I only know what it feels like. I can take it in different ways each time. In the middle of the river, there's a brown and white pony stuck out on a rock with the current rushing by. The sun beats down and the wind whips up as a mutter of crows bursts into the sky. I got a lucid feeling like something inside me
is working up the courage to confront my own death. I step out in a water that's colder than anger, so cold it feels impossible to take my next breath. As I go under, I think about my mother. I think about her hands just a stroke in my face. I come up to the surface, I look up at the sky. I see swirls of red dust rising into space. Keep your head made up and press on. Your head raised up and press on.
I gather up some bread. So how long is the process? So for example, with the song Press On,
did you know at the moment? You mean how long did I take to come up with the song itself?
Yeah, once you were writing it.
The whole thing probably took, you know, even to make a little rudimentary demo, which did have its pluses, about 15 minutes. And I went in and probably had beans and rice and fried egg on top or something like that.
Is that helpful when you're structured like that, or do you need more space
really
sometimes?
Helpful. One of the greater tools is either to have like a sand dial or a timer on your phone, and all sorts of restrictions help. In other words, if I had, you know, all year to write you a song, you know, whatever, it wouldn't, maybe in the 11th hour I'd write it. But if you said to me, I'm going to pay you X amount of money and I need it by Tuesday, there's two things going on at once. One is the validation that you appreciate what I have to offer, and that it's in the form of lucre. You're showing that appreciation. That makes my internal judgment center kind of open wide. Like, this guy already likes what I do, so it's going to be cool. And it's Tuesday, not some nebulous time. That will give me this structure within which to work and, you know, kind of corral all my resources very quickly.
Did you know when you were writing this already that you were not going to release it for another year after it came together?
You know, I would probably, that kind of thought would interrupt the process, you know, gravely. It's about like, you know, if somebody's, you know, having some intimate moment and they're thinking about their Aunt Bessie in her grave, that could forestall the proceedings. I mean, while I was writing, because of that particular song at that time, it was very fast. I was writing it quickly, and I was, you know, concurrently aware that this was something special. But if that awareness starts to intrude, you know, like, then you wake up from the little dream that you're in. So it's a very delicate balance of these different facets of intellect, imagination. You know, they need to fuse together, but they have to be in a right balance. I mean, this is sort of crazy to describe it like that, but, you know, that's how it sometimes goes.
It's organic.
And then there are songs that you write that are completely analytical. You know, this line goes this, and this is exactly what I need to write about. It needs to have a linearity. It needs to have a clear narrative. I've made 5 albums of children's songs. So while there is this initial impetus, this sense of wading into the unknown, there has to be a very clear narrative. Same with country songs generally.
Speaking of the children's line, I'm taking us away from Press On for a sec. I'm just curious, what was the catalyst for the children's albums, which are really fun?
Yeah, that's a very specific catalyst. I had just had maybe 1 or 2 kids at the time. I was living, you know, in Santa Monica, and somebody called me. I was still on a record label, but, you know, they called me and said, I'm going to give you X amount of money, just like I was saying, to make a kid's record, and I need it by such and such a time. Those are the two best things you can hear, or two of the best. And I didn't, you know, I hadn't really written kids' records, and I popped out a bunch of stuff, you know. Bucky the Tiny Horse, the Bucky the Talking Horse, Little Bitty Baby, My Best Friend is a Salamander. I mean, they all probably came to me in a few days because there was a need. I needed the money too.
On that note, do you feel, I mean, kids' songs obviously are silly, and I love that.
No, they're not silly.
To my point, they can be
silly at all.
They can,
like Roald Dahl and, you know.
Right.
So, not silly. They're just in a language that children can appreciate.
Right, right. So how do you tie that together? I mean, because sometimes, you know, my best friend is a salamander. I remember playing that for my daughter. That was, she, you know, like 3-4 years old then. Silliness, but still there's lessons to be learned. And I also found it musically interesting for me. You know, kids at that time, you know, kids music was sometimes rough to listen to.
A lot of it was pretty obsequious. So.
Yeah. So, but you brought an adult aspect to it, but also appealing to children. So what was the secret sauce there?
Well, I mean, it was just like, first of all, I didn't have any intention of writing a song that will teach kids about, you know, racial harmony. That wasn't my intention. I just sat down and my best friend is a salamander. I don't know how it just, once I get into this sort of dreamlike headspace, something will come. And once that line, you know, my best friend is a salamander comes, I just imagine I'm walking through the house and I see everything that I'm seeing in the salamander house. And I just write it down. And then I understood that this was a song that was funny and somewhat absurdist, but also there was a special quality about it. It's a serious song about differences, but it's told in a language that children can appreciate. And hopefully adults won't want to like, oh God, let's get off of that.
Similar to some of the brilliant cartoons that are like The Simpsons that are made for like kids like them, but it's adult
like
humor.
The Flintstones were made for, you know, it was made for adults. The kids, we didn't probably get half the jokes at all.
Exactly.
So does that happen? Like sometimes you hear a phrase like my best friend is a salamander that worked for you. The same, I guess, I was reading about Shelter in Peace, this new song you created. While we've been quarantined in a way, someone said that to you and that was the impetus for a new song. Is that something that inspires you immediately?
That's definitely something. I mean, this friend of mine signed a text with that. I'm like, I said to her right away, I'm like, damn, that's, you know, let's just take, for example, here to exemplify what you're talking. Now, I can open up pretty much any book, which I sometimes do if I like, I just need some inspiration. This is a book about the First World War. It's really terse. It's hard to read through. But I'm going to take the book and I'm going to point to a paragraph. So let's see. But the Allies were less willing to jettison their claim. The British wanted full restoration for Bettelmann to return, while the German leaders, except for Kluman and briefly Bettelmann, insisted on continuing control. Nor would they cede more than a fraction. So there's a line that pops out to me right there. You know, I could go, it's been a long time slipping around, trying to get some, long time slipping around, trying to gain some traction. The way I miss you, baby, is a lot more than a fraction. Not the greatest, but there you have an idea of how that could work. You know, inspirations are from cereal boxes. This says in this book he shows how in 1 year the war was transformed. You could just say, hey, in one day my world was transformed. That's a good title. How my world was transformed. I mean, it's everywhere. And then you start in like that.
That's an artist. I don't know that, David, or I could do that.
No, it's, well, I actually.
Well, you never tried. I mean, I've been doing this since I'm 12 years old. So, I mean.
Yeah, actually, I just finished a book by another great Jewish singer-songwriter, Jeff Tweedy, who wrote this book, How to Write a Song in a Day. or just no, how to write one, how Jeff to write
Tweedy
just.
Was, is Jeff Tweedy Jewish?
He just,
converted.
Thank you. Jeez.
Interesting.
Yes, he did convert.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Same ideas in this book. It's like a short little book and it's, just motivational and kind of what you go to is like, take a subject, write something describing it. And just kind of inspiring yourself to, you know, sit down at a desk and create something. You know, I think you've done something like that too. You have, like with your Big Muse company, just encouraging people to be creative, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is. And that's a, you know, creativity is something very difficult to define. The way I've kind of looked at it for a decade or so is that it's one state when you, one is not being imposed upon by their sense of judgment. Their internal judgment is not pressing upon them. And one way that you get around it, and at least in terms of songwriting, is to become inured to writing horrible stuff. And that thing that I just sang you, More Than a Fraction, that's freaking god-awful. But nonetheless, it doesn't hurt me to do that. So that may be something I would use. And I've written so many things that are not serviceable. They're just not good. And when you look, for example, at the sculpturist Calder, the artist, the mobilist, and you see pictures of his studio, you see that there's things all over the place. There's bent wire. There's pictures on napkins. There's just stuff. Now, is all that going to go into a museum? Probably, because he's so famous. But did he intend it to? No. Some of it was just some, you know, junk hanging around. So part of it is being unafraid to be terrible.
But something's inspiring that.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to, you know, release all your terrible things into the world. But some people are, you know, I understand this very well because I work with people on this quite a bit. They're sense of judgment is so highly attenuated that the thought won't even arise in their own mind, let alone forget about putting it out on TV or something. They don't want to hear something in their own mind that's embarrassing. And I tell them, yeah. I wrote a book, which I was wondering if the people at Penguin Random House would not allow what I had written in the very end of the book. This is like making a final statement. And this is slightly untoward, but I'm going to try to put it in language that is less unpleasant, but nonetheless very true. You should view the flow of your creativity the same way you would view certain bodily functions. In other words, no one finds it abhorrent when they go to the bathroom. It's just like something that happens. You're not sitting and judging, and you're not, by the way, bringing it to the dinner table either. It's just there is a sense of flow. You're just like, let me see what's really in my mind. And it's a very beautiful thing when one's subconscious mind starts to open, because it's a lot better then all this stuff we have right away is basically the same shit we've been saying every day, you know?
All right, we're going to cut it off right now. We're in the middle of talking with Peter Himmelman. Stay right with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our chat with Peter Himmelman. You're talking about just, you know, some of it's not good when you bring it to the dinner table. Do you get feedback? And who do you get that feedback from?
Well, that's a great question. Now, something will have to cross my own personal threshold before I'll even take it to anyone. I think that I write songs for three people, maybe four. You know, I write them for my second cousin, probably my best friend, Jeff Victor, who has been a keyboardist with me for a long time. He's a musical genius. So I kind of have him in mind. I have my older son and some of my kids in mind. My older son is most interested in the things I do. My wife, whom I'm very reluctant to share anything with her, but I plan on one day when I'm writing that I could release it and she would hear it. And maybe a bass player friend of mine named Matt Thompson, who played on my new record. You know, just like, it's not 1,000 people. It's a small group.
Yeah.
You know, that I really want to share things with.
I'm curious why you're reluctant to go to your wife.
Oh, I think that I'd probably be a little bit more predisposed to taking it things to her now. Her judgment is so powerful that if she didn't like it, it would be over. So I fear that I would hear something negative. Now, she's an amazing poet. She writes things that make me like, where did that come from? And how did you that even come up with that? She's both methodical and can get into this sort of dream space that I'm talking about. And she'll share stuff with me all the time.
Can I ask you about, has location affected your songwriting? Because, I mean, you've lived in Santa Monica for so long, and now all of a sudden you find yourself in a...
It's affected it a lot. This is probably, I know for a fact that this is the longest period of time because of COVID that I have not performed or even played with another musician since I was 11 years old. It is the longest time that I have not performed live. You know, Zoom does not count. And there's something really wonderful and valuable about that, which I've only recently kind of stumbled on. Everybody, I believe... I have beliefs. I have no facts, by the way, just to make a caveat. Nothing I say is driven by data. You know, it's like, it's just my thought. So my thought is that anyone that gets up on stage and, you know, more so if they make a living out of it, they have a problem. it's both a problem and a blessing, because it stems, in my opinion, from a need for acknowledgement, which is outsized. Everyone has a need for acknowledgement. But people for whom the stage is their place, you get a, you know, to play for, you know, name the number of 50, 100, 10,000 of people that are clapping for you and then not, don't want you to leave because they love what you're hearing. They want an encore. You know, it's a kind of approval that most people never get in their lifetime. And it can be extremely dangerous. I mean, and I don't say that, you know, lightly. It can be so dangerous because in the absence of the applause, it's very easy to become depressed. And I've felt that way many times. But in this 6 months of not performing, you know, I found, and not even writing songs. I, by the way, to specific answer to your question, I have written probably the least amount I've ever written. Wow. You know, part of it was it's hard to write a bunch of new stuff until you've launched the stuff you've already done. So now maybe the refrigerator's cleared out and I could write some more. But I don't even have the slightest desire to write a song. Mm. You know, there's just a different kind of thing. So the move, you know, it wasn't just a physical move. It had sort of a metaphorical aspect as well. You're denying some stasis, or you're pushing against some inertia, and you're moving, and you're clearly moving across a continent. But in your mind, it's about movement too, to something else. And I've been writing songs and performing for the greatest part of my life. And it's interesting to see what happens, you know, when that isn't going on.
You brought me straw and kerosene. You brought me straw and kerosene. But I got no matches. Now I got no heat. I got a little excited, but it don't feel quite complete. You brought me straw and kerosene. You brought me straw and kerosene. Straw is wet, I can't get it ablaze. I've been trying to light it now for 11 nights and days. You ain't got a spark, you're never gonna light it up. You don't wanna fight it if you wanna light it up.
So you moved recently to New York, from Santa Monica to New York.
Yeah, that's right.
To be closer to your children and grandchild. Yeah, that's a
big thing, right. The grandchild wasn't even a thought when we moved. It's been an incredible surprise. I did write a song for him when he was probably the first week he was born. And that was really a very tense time. I'm sure you've talked to people in New York. So that was the epicenter of the pandemic. People were dying in droves, sirens out my window. They never abated, not once. I mean, every 5 minutes, another one would come, and they weren't people with sprained ankles. And you didn't know if you could touch anything. You couldn't go out. It wasn't like being in most other places in the world. And my daughter had her son in her apartment on 93rd Street. She was scheduled to go in the hospital. My wife was, you know, very wise. She just said, you know, a few days before, you're not going in the hospital. You're having it at home. And my daughter had been studying the Bradley method, which is kind of a
remember that
hippie kind of method. And, you know, she was planning on having no drugs at all. In order to qualify with midwifery, you had to know all this stuff. The midwife said she had, you know, hundreds more calls than she'd ever had in her whole career, because the hospitals were so deadly. So it was bleak. It was dark, physically dark. You know, it was winter and rainy. And I think my daughter didn't go out of the her little squalid apartment. And by the way, she was basically living alone because her husband is a doctor. Mm. He's an intern, ophthalmological resident, which he is now. And all of a sudden, he's on the front lines of COVID. Out of 20 patients of his, 19 died. So he wasn't in the apartment. He wasn't living with her for 2 months. The baby was, mm-hmm. you know, right. he left when the baby was a week old. So it was a very tense time, you know, very uncertain time.
And he's back now, I imagine.
Oh, he's back. They're living in New Jersey. That's why I need to, where I'm going after we get out of this conversation.
So is that what, I looked at your original cover and it was like, I think like a wagon was supposed to be the cover. And then all of a sudden we have a new album cover for Press On.
Yeah, all of a sudden my, you know, he was probably, I don't know, a few weeks old at the time. My daughter sent me that picture. I'm like, hey, can I, would you allow, you know, can you talk to my son? You know, they said, yeah. And, you know, he'll think it's cool when he gets older. Yeah. I mean, I had to do it with their permission. And it strikes me as a more fitting cover because his eyes, you know, he's an infant. His eyes are so open.
Mm-hmm. He's so full cute. Of
wonder and hope. And he's cute. And, you know, some of the songs are a little bit darkish.
Mm. That brings a little light. I wonder if people believe him in, you know, 30 years when he says, that's me.
Oh, yeah, they'll have to.
Talk to the Nevermind baby and see if see how that turns out.
Wonder yeah. how that works out.
And so, yeah, actually, with this music, you had recorded some music before. You were all set to record music, or it was recorded, and then you read a you saw a documentary? Is this what was the story?
Yeah, I mean, I had made all these demos for song after song. This is when I was really, you know, writing songs. I'm sure I'll get there again. And I found a batch of songs that I liked, and I called the producer and engineer of my record. His name is Sheldon Gomberg, genius musician, incredible guy. And I said, you know, let's get some people and plan this thing. And he got, I think it was like some Ben Harper's rhythm section. And, you know, we set a date, which I sometimes do for the way into the future, but I'll set the date, which will be the pressure I need to actually make the record, similar to what I'm talking about. You know, you have to have these constraints. There's no more record company expecting a record mm-hmm. from me. That those days have come and gone. And then I saw the, it's called Chasing Train. I saw the documentary one night. A beautiful documentary about him constantly trying to get to something more essential, something to tell his ineffable story better, however he would do it. And I'm thinking, you know, I could do better. And I wrote a bunch of songs. A Press On was one of them. There, you know, I would say 60% of the songs were new and inspired after having watched that documentary.
This is my offering. You don't dance or sing. It ain't no diamond ring. You can't buy it at the five and dime. It's beyond logic, money or time. It's not a place or thing. This is my offering.
It's inspiring me to watch it.
Yeah, it's good.
But that's the confidence you had, like, to push yourself. Is that, do you need other outside forces to help you push on, or is this something internal that you have?
Well, I do. Like, I have a handful, a cadre of people that I would talk to. Yeah, I definitely need other people. It's funny, you know, when you see like Springsteen's album on the cover or whomever, you know, solo artist, there's no such thing as anyone doing anything of any merit by themselves. It's never happened in the history of the world. Everything, at some level it was a collaboration. And the more you collaborate with people who are both honest and encouraging, those are hard to find, you know, and they're not that many of them. I think without those people, I'll put it a positive spin, with those people, you know, you can achieve so much more than you ever dreamed. So, yeah, I rely on people all the time.
We are kind of an 80s music podcast, so we kind of have to refer to the 80s. I think we're legally obligated. So,
yes, I read through the charter.
So I guess I should refer, did you get that initially from Sussman Lawrence? Like, you know, being in a band and pushing you constantly, you know, as a, you know, teenager. And
or, yeah, you know. Yeah, it's really, it's nice that you talked about that. That Sussman Lawrence started at the end of the 70s, like 79 or something, into the 80s. And we were kids, you know, we were 18 years old. There were no adults helping us. There was no formal system. And we set up practice times, you know, 6-7 days a week, back when I wasn't keeping Shabbos, you know, from, you know, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. I mean, we were so strategic and so tactical and so disciplined. I mean, we were also nuts too. I remember one time it was raining. We took a break from practicing and there was this big mud hole out in the field at the junior high. And we all just ran through the mud, dove into the mud till we were complete zombie, you know, mud caked humans. But we were really determined. And, you know, we used to get in a lot of kind of arguments, mostly me and my cousin, Jeff Victor, but it was a real collaboration. Somebody told me something that may be apropos now of 80s bands or maybe 90s bands, but there were two bands, U2 and Guns N' Roses, that this writer and psychologist had explored. And she's a friend of mine named Ruth Blatt. And she said, the difference between the bands is a little unexpected as to why one went to become very successful and why one kind of tapered off. Now, you know, my thinking was that Guns N' Roses just probably was out of their minds into some sort of deep hedonistic stuff and the drugs, and they just blew up from that. And she said, yeah, no, that wasn't really what happened. You two were friends and they used to fight like cats and dogs over every issue. Guns N' Roses was this monolithic, what's the name, who's the lead singer?
Axl Rose.
Yeah. Axl Rose was kind of like, you know, he was running the show. And because it wasn't a real synthesis, a real collaboration, the animosities grew. That weren't like regular fighting that I used to do with my band, Sussman Lawrence. Those were just collaborations, like Israeli, you know, politics. Mm-hmm. This was, it grew into, because of this, you know, monolithic leadership style, into true animosity. The guys in Sussman Lawrence, even though we used to fight and everything, I couldn't love them more than I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I love all of them.
I think I think songwriting is the same thing. They, with U2, everyone got credit for songwriting. REM, same thing. Not so much Guns N' Roses, you know.
You know, when I started my solo career, it was really great. It was really liberating. You know, I could make all the decisions myself, and you know, I had the Sussman Lawrence guys on several of the first albums. But I read Keith Richards' autobiography. Mm-hmm. And I started getting homesick for a band, like a real band that could just give me shit and said, what are you talking about? This bullshit sucks. And I think in some ways I suffered for that, for not having that.
Even though it was like in the 80s, it kind of morphed into the Peter Himmelman band. It was still a collaboration. Did you feel that, or is that?
Yeah, it was, but it was much different. Now I was paying them.
Okay.
Yeah. It makes a big difference. And you know, I always, you know, was the leader of the Sussman Lawrence band by, you know, whatever. But I had to argue every point. I had to fight for everything. Mm-hmm. Here, I could just say no, and everyone would maybe be pissed off, but like, whatever.
You do what you say.
I mean, it was, you know, I don't think there was any rancor there, but I don't think there was quite as much freedom to say, go, you know, screw off.
Yeah.
Hopefully once this pandemic one day lifts in 2025, we'll hear about the Peter Himmelman, his new band project.
I'm hoping that comes a lot sooner.
Though, me too.
I know we have to wrap it up, but I do have one question. Again, a random question I want to ask you that I'm just curious about personally. Synesthesia. I'm assuming that you wrote that because it affects you.
Well, I didn't write it because it affected me. And I think to some small extent, every musician has it. I mean, it's not uncommon for a musician to say, hey, you know, play something that just sounds like a piece of rock or a hard sound, like a wall, or play something that's kind of like swamp green. You know, every musician could respond to that because there is a bit of synesthesia where you're, you know, seeing sound and, you know, hearing colors. For people that actually have it, it's an unbelievably debilitating disease. Yeah. I got the idea from reading something from, you know, biblical literature, Torah commentary, where upon the giving of the Torah, the Hebrews heard what was normally seen and saw what was normally heard. They, what did it say? They saw the thunder and heard the lightning. You know, everything was reversed. They had kind of transcended the normal sensory order. And I liked the name of it. It was very hard for DJs to pronounce the title. What the hell? I'm not trying to make it easy on them.
No, I was curious because I thought I wanted to know how it impacted you if you had it. But I understand what you're saying about musicians and or artists.
But I do have this one song I want to play if I can.
Please.
I was on Zoom with Holly and Dave. I saw in their faces two folks that were wise and brave. Dave was wearing blue, Holly was wearing white. I could have sat here and talked to them people along into the night. But now it's T-neck time for me. T-neck time for me. I've got a grandchild and a daughter to see. Something I've been working on for a while.
Well, I see our time is up. Well,
we have a new theme song.
Oh man, I could just write you guys one. That'd be so fun, you know.
You do anytime. Make it seem like it's a lot of fun. I'm going to have to pick up a pen and start trying this thing out.
Try
a guitar.
It. Write to me and tell me what you come up with.
All right. There we go. Collaboration. Let's start a band.
That's it. You do need to find an architecture for your lyrics, a form, a structure. So go look at any song that you like an old Beatles song. I was just 17 and you know what I mean. Down and out for song, down and out. I'm going to dance with another since I saw her saying. You just map out what somebody else did, because without a structure, it'll just be nebulous and formula, you know, formless.
So we're going to look at some Peter Himmelman songs.
Look at mine. Mine have, if nothing else, they all have solid structure to them. Yes.
That's what we always say. Peter Himmelman, solid structure. That's it.
I like that if somebody said that. All I want to say is to you guys, good yumtiv, Shana Tova. You should be happy, healthy, with all sorts of abundance of all good things.
Thank you, and Shana Tova to you as well. Enjoy the holiday.
Yes, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Peter Himmelman, the album is Press On. please get it. Give it a listen.
That's buy all you
it.
Can say.
Get, yeah. You know what?
Get listen
the,
to it.
Yeah. Listen to it. Buy it twice. Get the vinyl. Get the 8-track. Apparently you like 8-track tapes. So
I love them. I love them. Spin it. All right, you guys. All right. Talk to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Us.
Take care. Yeah,
bye-bye.
Bye. Be safe. Holy moly, Holly. Peter Himmelman wrote a song about us.
He wrote us a song. I'm amazed. I'm in awe. How nice to be able to do that at the drop of a hat, too.
That's what you call talent. That's something that, he's been doing this for 40 years. And so we have not.
That, since he was 11 years old, he said, right?
Yes. So it was exciting. He's just spontaneous. That's improv songwriting right there. That is amazing. So thank you to Peter Himmelman for joining us. Thank you to Carrie Baker of Conqueroo Publicity, who hooked us up with Peter. Thank you, Holly, for joining today. As you do
thank
every
you, Dave, for sharing this podcast with me.
Well, thank you. We do this every week. So, as a reminder, join us on our social networks. Where can they find us, Holly?
Oh, they can find us everywhere. They can find us on Facebook at What Difference Does It Make? On Instagram, WDDIM Podcast, Twitter, WDDIM Podcast, and on YouTube. Just look for What Difference Does It Make, and you can hear little snippets and outtakes of our shows. It's super fun.
There you go. You can sign up for our newsletter on our website, WDDIMPodcast.com. So thanks again for joining us, and until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.